Welcome on to a Sunday edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Today I'm joined by Sports Illustrated's Rob Mahoney. Rob, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Nate.
Yeah, so interesting time here. We've got a lot of time in between games. A few things we'll go over. We'll take a look at the finals, obviously, which start in we're finally halfway through this desert of games. And then so maybe talk about a couple of the coaching hires, and then Rob's, he's always been a Dallas guy, still based out of there, so I figured we could talk some Mavs off-season with him as well. So Rob, first of all, I mean, are you making a finals pick? Can we ask you for that, or are you saving that for the digital pages of Sports Illustrated?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not too protective of it or anything like that. it's more just a matter of, I mean, I'm going to be picking the Warriors, assuming that Klay Thompson's concussion issue is cleared up in time for him to play some kind of role in the series. Obviously, if it drags on and he misses four or five games, then it's a wholly different, you know, completely different picture. But assuming he's healthy enough to contribute in some way, I think I'm fall somewhere between the Warriors in five and Warriors in six camps, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I still haven't quite made my official pick, and I think I'll wait for Thompson to be back. I mean, all reports are that he's going to be good because. I mean, those are the indications, at least. Steve Kerr said he expects him back. He's not even planning, doing any kind of game planning for him not to be there. And Ron Adams reported that he was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Very solid medical diagnosis there. So it sounds like he's going to make it back. But, yeah, I mean, I think – so why don't we just assume that he's going to be there in this analysis unless we hear anything differently. I'm thinking either – I'm kind of more on the 6-7 line than the 5-6 line right now because I'm starting – maybe Cleveland, I think, has fooled me too many times.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's totally fair, especially with the way that they've played in these playoffs. I mean, I can't – for some reason, I can't get the image out of my head of what LeBron went through last postseason, and I see maybe a similar course in terms of the way that Golden State's defense starts reacting to the way that the Cavs play. Where you get to that point where LeBron is great, and he's obviously been so good for them all throughout these playoffs, and he's able to do so much by himself. But at some point when you're facing a great defense, they're able to cover up so many of those other holes. I do wonder if they're going to have enough there. And just, you know, on top of that, being that between these two defenses, I trust the one that's been there for the whole regular season and most of the playoffs, as opposed to, you know, this Cavs defense, which while it's been great in the postseason, I still have my questions as far as, like, you know, Tristan Thompson has been very good, but is the upgrade of him over Kevin Love so significant that it's making this kind of impact?
Yeah, I mean, maybe what you also consider, too, is how little Kyrie has played. I think it's a pretty big upgrade from him to Dellavedova as well.
No, no doubt, no doubt. I mean, that Kyrie, especially defensively, I'm curious to see how mobile he is, just how much he's able to keep with, you know, if he's guarding Steph, if they're going to hide him on Harrison Barnes, how he's able to compete there in terms of if Barnes tries to, you know, overpower him or go down to the post. He's going to have his hands full. I mean, a lot of people have talked about the Warriors just don't give you – they don't really have many opportunities to hide defenders, except when you get to that bench and you can go to, you know, Livingston or Andre Iguodala or one of those guys. But, I mean, Kyrie's going to have to work pretty hard. I do wonder, you know, with his mobility, just how engaged he'll be and how effective he'll be.
I thought he looked pretty good in game four. What did you think?
I thought
against the Hawks.
Yeah, no, I definitely think so. I think on the broadcast they were saying something about how his run looked, you know, his gait looked strange, which I didn't really see that at all. He looked, I mean, obviously the shot was going, you know, that always helps.
Yeah.
But yeah, to me it's just a completely different type of matchup going from, you know, even guarding a guy like Jeff Teague, who's an effective player and a guy who's demanding in his own way in terms of what you're guarding in the pick and roll. To, you know, guarding whether it's Steph or, you know, I don't think he'll see much time on Clay. But, yeah, probably Steph or Harrison Barnes, I would imagine, is where he starts out, and we'll see kind of how he does there.
Yeah, I mean, he could get stuck on Clay in the cross match, too, if the Warriors decide to guard him with Clay. Yeah, and, I mean, also when you consider the way that they were defending the pick and roll, going so far under that I think you know, that's not nearly as demanding as what he has to do with Curry, because really your point guard's so important with Curry because your big has to get out there. And Curry can string that out. Like, the sooner that point guard can get back in front and release the big to go back, the better your defense is going to be. And, you know, that's not something that's been a huge strength of Kyrie's.
No, no, not at all. And, yeah, I mean, it's obviously a very different thing when, as you said, you're going from daring Jeff Teague to shoot and making him prove it, which is something that, you know, worked out really well for them, and it turned out to be a really sound strategy. But, yeah, that's just not feasible in this kind of matchup. And then, plus, I mean, the kind of strain that their adjusted defense is going to put on guys like Thompson, where while I think he did a great defensive job, you know, against Millsap and some others in the last series, but, you know, he over the course of the regular season sometimes was a little shaky in his rotation, just, you know, will space out a little bit, will be a tad late. He's going to have to be very punctual, especially when if they're able to pull Mozgov up high, you know, higher than he's comfortable. It's going to be interesting to see what Thompson's able to do and how reliable he's going to be in those defensive rotations.
Yeah, to me, I thought one of their big issues during the regular season wasn't even so much the personnel once they got those new guys on board in the trade, but it was just that the communication wasn't quite there for them. And I thought that the Hawks were really, really going to stress that. But I thought in that first half of game one, the Cavs actually really did struggle to defend. And then Atlanta couldn't hit any open shots. They were going under everything. So Atlanta's ball movement was totally stymied by the fact that they weren't able to get that initial penetration. I think the Warriors are going to finally be the first team that's really going to test them by moving the ball side to side.
No, I think you're absolutely right, especially the point about the penetration, where when you're guarding Teague the way that they did, it makes it very hard for him to kind of get into the lane and force, you know, the next move, and really pull the defense into rotation. Yeah, I mean, both those teams can move the ball really well, but with the caliber of threat that Steph is on the floor, and by extension Clay when he's moving off the ball, and, you know, when they get rolling and they get the ball moving from side to side, as you mentioned, I mean, that's where so many of the flaws in team defense come out. And yeah, it's one thing where I think you're spot on in terms of the personnel, where they have some holes. You know, Kyrie, I think, has improved this year, but is not the best defender. You know, guys like J.R. Smith are not super talented individually, but overall they are able to make things work by kind of limiting the access to those in between zones where you're caught mid rotation, where you're caught, you know, moving from one guy to the next. The way they defended Atlanta really minimized those situations. But the Warriors, I don't know how much you can minimize that, just because Curry, just by the very act of guarding him, kind of pulls you into that game.
Do you you think Mozgov is going to be able to stay on the floor in this series?
I don't think he's going to be able to play. I mean, I can't remember where it was mentioned. I think maybe it was on the Starters, excuse me, on their podcast. They were talking about how he and Bogut may be kind of matched for minutes, and I think it makes the most sense for a lot of reasons. But when you look at, you know, the way Bogut's minutes totals have been in some previous series, the Cavs rely on Mozgov for a lot, and I don't know that, especially when the Warriors go smaller, that he's really going to have that much of a place. And, you know, then you get into the ripple effects of how does that influence the Cavs' offensive rebounding? How does it, you know, influence that, you know, maybe their spacing improves by getting another small on the floor, but there's going to be some reciprocal cost to that that I think hurt the Cavs a lot more than it'll hurt the Warriors.
Yeah, if they're not going to be able to have an effect on the offensive glass, I think a lot of their offense is going to be stymied. I think another thing too is LeBron hasn't been able to make a jump shot for, you know, since basically the Cavs series, it's the Celtics series, maybe even before that. So with him more dependent now on this kind of bully ball post-ups, I didn't think that the other teams did as good of a job as they could have, that the Cavs have played helping off of Thompson and Mozgov when both of those guys were in the game. I think the Warriors will do a much better job of that. I rewatched the game over the one game they played when LeBron was in the lineup, and when they did those ISO post-ups, the Warriors were bringing someone over strong side, and then they have the length and quickness on the backside to kind of take care of both Thompson and Mozgov, although there is the offensive rebounding situation as well in there, when that happens.
Yeah, I mean, their offensive rebounding has been such a weird weapon throughout these playoffs. But, yeah, I'm definitely the same mind as you in terms of when both of those guys are on the floor, there are ways where you can help and kind of mitigate the damage that comes through those offensive boards. I think there are ways to stop this Cavs offense, and, you know, it's a very easy thing for me to say, and it's certainly a very easy thing for me to say when I don't have to worry personally about, you know, guarding LeBron and dealing with everything that comes with that. But you know, if you look at kind of how the Warriors defended the Rockets in the last series in terms of kind of playing James Harden one-on-one for the most part, really sticking to shooters, really trying to take away, you know, the kickouts to the three-point line, the lobs, you know, in the middle, I think you can play LeBron in some similar ways, and he's an even more effective player than Harden. He's an even better passer in terms of what he's able, you know, the angles he's able to access, and that's going to be tough for them in order to cut all those off. But I trust them to do it, and I trust that defense and that coaching staff to do it, you know, more than most in the NBA, certainly.
Well, so what do you think? Do you think then the Cavs are going to be closing games? What do you see as their closing lineup here in most of these games?
I see the, you know, I guess probably the Tristan Thompson at center and then running small for the most part, you know, depending on, you know, assuming Kyrie is all ready to go, and we have every indication that he is, you know, he and Shumpert and Smith and LeBron probably, just not only because we've seen them close that with that lineup plenty, both in the regular season and the playoffs. I just think it makes the most sense for the Warriors, and as much as they would like to run big in those end of game situations where things can be even more chaotic than usual, and you really need, you know, to avoid the cross matches as much as possible, to avoid those transition mismatches as much as possible, I think that probably makes the most sense for them, given what the Warriors run.
Yeah, it'll also be interesting, too, to see how the Warriors are going to guard some of those 1-3 and 3-1 pick and rolls by the Cavs. I mean, that's something I don't see them switching when Curry is on the floor. But those have obviously been real deadly for other teams to try and stop at the end of games.
Oh, no, they're really tough. And, yeah, I think you're right in terms of that's just a really – a really bad situation to put Curry in if you switch him onto LeBron in those situations. I mean, that there's no easy answer for it, certainly. But I think it's one of those things where you hope for the recovery on the back line. You hope you can fight through. You hope that you don't have to rely on the switching in those situations. Or, you know, potentially if Clay is guarding Kyrie Irving, then it makes it maybe a little easier to switch if you really want to do that. But, you know, I don't know to what extent they'll really end up doing that in this series.
Yeah, it's that's a good point. I mean, I don't think that Clay has the heft to guard some of these post-ups from LeBron. But, you know, maybe in the late clock, that's something that could work a little bit better for them. I think, really, for Cleveland, they're so focused on attacking some of these mismatches. I think it's going to be important for them to get the ball up court quickly to where if there is a switch that they have time to attack it. Because, you know, if you get a switch with 7 or 8 on the shot clock, there's not time for LeBron to go down in the post and bully people. And then, you know, with someone like Clay on him and his jumper not working, he might struggle a little bit to get some efficient offense. I mean, but really what he's been doing a lot is just totally running the clock down. I don't know if that's going to work against Golden State the way it has against some of these other teams.
No, and I mean, that's probably somewhere where Golden State might even be a little bit underrated in terms of, obviously, they like to switch maybe more than any team in the NBA, but they also really excel in forcing opponents to kind of stall out. You know, guys like Andre Iguodala might be, you know, one of the best denial defenders in the NBA. Klay Thompson's obviously really good about locking and trailing guys around screens, where they'll take away your first option, they'll take away your second option on whatever play call you've drummed up. And then, like you said, when you get to that point where it's, okay, we have 8-9 seconds off the shot clock, LeBron's trying to get something in ISO or something in the pick and roll, those switches really aren't as detrimental, and you can handle them in those little short bursts. And, you know, the Warriors personnel obviously accommodates that really well.
So I agree with you that I think Cleveland's closing lineup is going to be Thompson at center with LeBron at the four, and then with the three smalls, all of who can shoot it, Shumpert, Smith, and Kyrie. If you are the Warriors, are you going with the Green at center lineup, or are you going with Andrew Bogut at the four and then Green guarding either one of the smalls or LeBron?
I'm sure we'll see some of both. I'm inclined to think that by default, I mean, Steve Kerr, for as much as he likes the small lineup and what it brings, he's made very clear that, I mean, and this is true of a lot of small ball, that the more you run it, the more danger you run into of giving up those offensive rebounds. You're forcing guys like Draymond to do a lot in rotation. And then plus, I mean, I don't love the idea of, say, a Harrison Barnes trying to box out Tristan Thompson. You know, as good as he's been guarding bigs in these playoffs, keeping Alec Thompson on the boards is really challenging, as he's shown over these last couple of series. He works angles really well. He does his work early. He's very energetic. I would feel much more comfortable with a guy like Bogut down there, and I'm sure that they'll try to do that as much as they can. But again, it comes down to, you know, kind of the flow of the game and what they're able to get offensively with Bogut on the floor in this series.
To me, I think the best use of the small lineup will be when they come back with Mozgov in his second stint. He usually hasn't been closing for them, but he'll play a stint, you know, in the early in the second and fourth quarters as the center when Thompson gets his rest. I think that's actually a great time to break out the Green at center lineup, because Mozgov is not going to be able to guard that in transition or, you know, get out on Green at the three-point line, especially if they happen to have Curry in the game at those times, which they may not, but Kerr has switched around when he rests Thompson and Curry sometimes. I think that would be a great time to break that lineup out, because Mozgov probably not someone who's going to hurt you in the post too badly.
For sure. And it gets to that point too where, you know, as we talked about earlier with the Cavs hunting mismatches, if that's the mismatch you're hunting, is posting out Timofey Mozgov and you're getting the ball out of LeBron's hands and away from those three-point shooters, I think the Warriors would probably be just fine with that.
All right, well, so controversial question time. We've seen how the Cavs have done in these playoffs. We've seen their defense improve. Do you think that they are better, at least this year, not necessarily in the long term, without Kevin Love in there?
This is something I've been wrestling with a lot lately, trying to figure out, you know, where Love stands with this team. I don't think there's a good answer for it, just because with this sample that we've seen from the Cavs, it's so hard, especially with the competition that they had in the East. It's hard to, I find it hard at least to trust it just yet in terms of if this is really going to be, you know, basically a defensive juggernaut. When while they were a good defensive team in the regular season, we saw some problems there in terms of their execution. I don't think there's any question that if Kevin Love's back and they're playing big minutes, he doesn't fit as well what they're trying to do defensively. Even the way he was being used offensively, I don't think he'd be quite the same. I mean, he'd be a very different player, different in terms of the spacing, different in terms of the action you can run through him. But when you get into the playoffs and you want the ball in LeBron's hands as much as possible, and you want the ball in Kyrie's hands as much as possible, a guy like Thompson might fit better for them, given his offensive rebounding strengths and given his defensive versatility. It's really tricky to know if they're a better overall team. I think with the teams that they've played, I think the Thompson matchup works better for them, but the Warriors may be the kind of opponent where all that goes to hell.
Yeah, I do think that if they're not going to have a little bit more to it in the offense, that they may be in a little more trouble in this series. Now, you know, we thought that maybe Chicago, I think, defended them pretty well, although, you know, they just, some of their big men are a little more limited than Golden State's big men are, and they weren't a fantastic defensive team this year anyway. I think this is going to be a real good test. When Love's injury happened, I pretty much thought that the Cavaliers would not have a chance to win. They've exceeded expectations in my mind since then, but I'm still waffling, as it sounds like you are, on, you know, how good this Cavs team really has been versus, you know, how much has been just their competition not being that great.
Yeah, and it's really not a matter of disrespect or anything like that. There's just a burden of proof in terms of understanding where teams rest. I mean, there's a reason why we watch the entire regular season and we're constantly adjusting expectations, constantly adjusting our opinions of certain players and teams and how they work together. This is just a model of the Cavaliers that we haven't seen enough of yet, especially with, you know, even when they're running this lineup in the regular season, you know, these lineups without Kevin Love in the regular season, LeBron was playing a completely different style of basketball. He was almost completely disengaged defensively on a lot of nights. Offensively, he wasn't dominating the ball the way he is right now. Kyrie's situation was obviously very different with his injuries. So this is a small sample size of small sample sizes. I think we'll learn more, you know, going through these finals and potentially next season, you know, depending on what Love decides to do. But, you know, they've been incredible in these playoffs. It's just a matter of seeing them against the right kinds of competition.
Well, let's see. What else did I want to ask you about here? How would you assess the job that David Blatt has done for Cleveland in these playoffs?
I think he's been pretty solid, you know, and certainly, you know, the record obviously speaks to that. In that sense, he's pretty unimpeachable. You know, I definitely didn't envision them beating the Hawks the way they did. I thought, I thought Atlanta was going to get a lot more going offensively in terms of exploiting, you know, some of the Cavs' problems in terms of those defensive exchanges. I thought the Hawks would probably win the series, all told. I predicted Hawks in six. That obviously did not happen. But Vlad, you know, in the micro game, I think Vlad has done a pretty good job of dealing with not only defensive assignments, but some little tweaks to their system. Offensively, I don't necessarily love what they're running, but it's also one of those cases where it's not like they're running a David Vlad offense. You know, it's it's at the mercy of LeBron right now, and that can get you. You know, it's obviously gotten them so far. It'll be interesting to see if they can introduce some wrinkles that could help them get through Golden State's defense, but that's a tough thing to kind of adjust to at this late stage in the playoffs.
I think that he, and a lot of overseas coaches, I think, are a little more like this, where you don't kind of have the superstar system in Europe. And this is a bit of an aside, but when you're kind of dealing with, you know, you don't have the outlier players who are top 10, top 20 players in the world. So the talent level among players on your own team and on the opposite team is kind of much more similar in Europe. And so the coaches there, and especially Vlad, I think, are kind of ruthless pragmatists as far as the way they're going to guard people or who they're going to play. And, you know, I think that's kind of shown a little bit, especially in his strategy to just make those guys on Atlanta prove that they could hit a shot. You know, I mean, I think a lot of coaches have been like, oh, this is a great shooting team, we got to get it out on him. He's like, no, Paul Millsap, Dennis Schroeder, Jeff Teague, like, you are going to have to hit three-pointers. And until you do that, we're not going to respect you out there. And I thought that that was a very, very effective strategy for them.
No, it definitely has been. He's done some really impressive things in that regard. Just, you know, that's the kind of, the kind of approach that might be taken for granted, because it seems very obvious to make shooters shoot, to make guys that are, you know, 35-33% three-point shooters, to force them to take those open shots. Guys like Paul Millsap, where if he knocks down his open shots, it's a very different game and a very different series. But when he doesn't, and the percentages show that maybe it's not the safest bet in the world for Atlanta's offense to be bogged down there, that it can really work out to their advantage. You know, I've been very impressed with, as you said, these little kind of pragmatic adjustments that he's made, the little pragmatic decisions. And then I think you guys even talked about it, you and Danny on the podcast, maybe last week, about how he's managed, you know, the kind of veteran guys on the team who are expected to make a difference. I certainly did not, you know, even in the regular season when James Jones was making periodic appearances, he reeked of a player who was just going to disappear from the rotation entirely in the playoffs because he's James Jones. And we've seen over the last couple of years, he just didn't look like an NBA player. And yet he's giving them important rotation minutes, while guys like Sean Marion and Mike Miller, who at least I envisioned would be a much bigger part of this team, you know, when we were going into the preseason, and they really haven't been at all. And so, I mean, those kinds of things take guts. And it's very easy at home to say, oh, you adjust the starting lineup. Oh, you put in this guy. Oh, you don't play this guy anymore. But those are real human decisions that are often difficult for coaches to make, especially when, you know, Sean Marion and Mike Miller signed with this team for a reason. And to give those guys DNPs, I mean, you have to know what you're doing. You have to be confident in it. And David Vlad is both of those things.
You mentioned James Jones. I think this might be the series where he starts to get exposed a little bit, especially defensively. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough.
Because if he's going to play as a small ball four, he's going to be matched up with Barnes. I think Barnes can really hurt him quite a bit, whether it's driving by him on closeouts or, you know, anytime James Jones has to guard someone coming off a screen, I think it's not really going to work that well. Or same thing with pick and roll defense. So I think the Warriors having more, or I would rather say not having the non-threats that some of these other teams did, should be able to take advantage of Jones a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, when you imagine Harrison Barnes in the corner, James Jones trying to recover out to him and take away the dribble at the same time, or him trying to pick up Draymond Green in transition, or even, you know, even say worst case scenario, Draymond picks up a lot of quick fouls early, he's forced into foul trouble, say the Warriors have to play David Lee a lot more than they would like. That's even a case where David Lee could be a nice little weapon for them in terms of his ability to power through a guy like James Jones. I mean, Jones has given them good minutes. He's been better than expected. But, I mean, you have to imagine that at some point he turns back into a pumpkin.
I will respectfully disagree with you on the James Jones-David Lee matchup. I think, actually, if they get matched up, that would be a huge advantage for the Cavs. And I don't expect Lee to play a ton this series because of his lack of rim protection. I don't think Lee can get out on Jones at the three-point line. And Jones has been making everything, too. And he's still, despite his limitations, he's a tall guy with long arms. He's got a high release that's tough to close out on. I think that actually would be that would be bailing the Cavs out if you're going to put David Lee and match him up with Jones.
No, totally fair.
And also, yeah, I mean, Lee just, he's just not in the kind of shape that he was last year. I don't think he doesn't have enough explosion to me anymore to really be an effective weapon in the post the way he was at times last year. So I don't know. What happens to him this offseason is a whole separate topic, but just seeing him regularly, I mean, I don't think that he has done the best job of staying in shape when he hasn't been playing. So I think it would surprise me a lot if he sees more than like token minutes in this series.
No, I certainly don't expect him to. Yeah, definitely behind the glass in case of emergency. And if it really comes to that, the Warriors are going to have much bigger problems.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think Azili will be another interesting guy. And I haven't heard anything about Spates yet. Have you, whether he's going to be back? I think he's still injured from what I hear.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything as far as an update on that front.
Yeah, I mean, I think, but with the way Azili has been playing, I think you probably go with him over Spates, even if healthy. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. No, Azili's been great. I mean, his development this season relative to a few years back where, I mean, what this is such a stupid thing to say, but what a difference being able to catch a ball makes. You know, him being an alley-oop target, him being a more reliable finisher in the pick and roll. He's always been, you know, a competent or a quality defender, depending on what aspect of defense you're talking about. You know, he certainly had those moments where Dwight Howard got the better of him in the conference finals, but overall, I think he's given them some really solid minutes for what you're expecting out of that part of the rotation, and his ability to at least be there offensively in a way that, you know, maybe he doesn't demand constant attention, but he's going to be able to make the defense pay at least a little bit if you leave him, you know, too unattended.
Yeah, he was very solid on the offensive glass as well in that last game. So that's certainly something that's pretty useful. And I think the Warriors can actually make some hay on the offensive glass in this series. They had a couple of games against Houston where they really kind of went wild. And with Cleveland not a team that's going to run on you, for whatever reason, I mean, they probably should more, but that's just not really in their DNA, it seems. You might as well attack the offensive glass. What's the downside?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not been a huge priority for the Warriors, but this is the kind of thing that playoff matchups dictate, is that if the opportunity is there, and a guy like Azili is not going to be essential for your transition defense, especially when, you know, as you said, if it's Mozgov or Thompson on the floor, Thompson runs the floor much better than Mozgov does, but, you know, he's not going to be the first line of defense back there. It may not be essential that he's back on every single possession, especially when guys like Kyrie and LeBron push so fast. It's much more important that your transition guys are back. You know, I think you give it a shot. You would give him a little more freedom there than you might some other guys, and see what he comes up with.
So, have you had a chance to rewatch that that game from the regular season at all?
I have not.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I'll save that for another guest then to talk about that. But yeah, I mean, we got like plenty of finals previews shows to come here during this downtime. So what do you think if you were the Warriors, are you going with Klay Thompson on Kyrie, or are you going to start off with Curry on him?
I mean, I think they'll start with Curry on him, just based on what we've seen in previous matchups and previous series. I think I might do the same, just to see what Curry can give you there. I think you can be pretty confident in the idea that Klay will be able to be more of an imposition. But it's nice to see up front, and it may be kind of deflating for the Cavaliers to see up front. If you put Curry there and he does a good job and Kyrie isn't able to get going, not only does that, you know, save Klay the trouble, and we've seen in previous series where he's had some, you know, when he's guarded, you know, James Harden, for example, you know, it's trickier for him to get his offense going, and, you know, naturally, I mean, it wears you down. But if Curry's able to give quality minutes there, and I'm sure you're going between the two guys, I think that could be a really nice kind of psychological weapon for them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think a lot of this is, I mean, number one, I think that clearly the best way to stop them defensively is to put Klay on them. Don't you agree with that?
Yes.
And so maybe it's overthinking to say it should be Curry. You can definitely put Curry on Amon Shumpert very easily. I don't think you really have to worry about that matchup much. Maybe when you have J.R. Smith out there, who's been such an X-factor for the Cavs, you might want to go with Klay. I think Klay is if he's locked in, is a good matchup for J.R. Smith. But then we saw when they took him off of Harden, he wasn't nearly as locked in guarding some of those other guys. And he was, I thought he was a big problem in that game four when the Rockets just went wild from three-point range.
Yeah. No, I mean, he's had some rough moments. And the other matchup I'm curious to see, too, is exactly what the Warriors decide to do with Iguodala in terms of who he guards, because, you know, he's not quite the defender he was over the last couple of years. And we see some problems, especially, you know, he'll die on some screens. He'll brush off with some contact sometimes. So I wonder if the options are, you know, if the matchups dictate that Iguodala could guard either J.R. Smith or Kyrie Irving, I wonder if you're maybe better off putting him on Kyrie for a little while, just assuming he's not spending a lot of time guarding LeBron, which I would, you know, I'm thinking might be more Harrison Barnes and Draymond Green, but we'll see. I'd be curious to see if Iguodala would be an option there on Irving, just because, you know, I think on-ball defense is a little bit more predictable in terms of the contact than off-ball defense can be. And J.R. can, I mean, he's not exactly a Klay Thompson, Kyle Korver type, but he does move a good bit without the ball. And if you can clear Iguodala off of, you know, off of the coverage there with some hard screens, I wonder if he may be better used kind of throwing him at Kyrie, putting his length there and seeing what he can do.
That's an interesting thought. You know, I can't remember a time in his time with the Warriors that Iguodala has guarded point guards regularly. Can you?
No, I mean, I think it's been one of those ideas that we talked about as being part of his great potential with that team, but it just never really worked out that way in the matchups in terms of what the team was actually doing.
I like him a lot as an off-ball guy guarding someone like Shumpert.
Okay.
Shumpert is in the game because when LeBron goes to those post-ups from the left block, and especially if you're bringing over your big to the near side block, then you need guys on the backside who really understand how to rotate and get into the passing lanes. I think that Iguodala may be the best in the league at that particular aspect of defense. So I like him a lot there. I guess the question is, who do you think is the best guy on LeBron? Just from a pure standpoint, like not considering where else you're going to be weak, but if you say, all right, I need to just stop LeBron, I know he's going to try and score on this possession, who on the roster are you going with?
I mean, a lot of it depends on exactly what the lineup looks like at the time, because I think when Bo gets on the floor, it could be a different answer.
Like you might go with someone a little smaller in that case because you know he's underneath there if they try to post up. Is that the thinking?
Yeah. Like I might be – like Harrison Barnes is not an elite defender by any means, and he's giving up quite a bit of weight to LeBron in terms of if he tries to go to the post there. But the idea of Harrison Barnes on the ball – with both Draymond and Bogut in a position to rotate and help. And as you said, maybe Iguodala's on the floor with them, maybe Klay's on the floor with them, and you know, somebody who can play passing lanes if it turns into that kind of possession. But the idea of having length on the ball with two guys behind him who can help, depending on what the spacing looks like, is at least somewhat appealing to me. The easy answer, I think, is Draymond, just because of the body and the mobility.
Yeah.
And, you know, how good he is, you know, especially when you're getting into the post, which, as we talked about, is where LeBron's making hay right now. I think he's the default answer to this question, probably the real answer to this question. But I guess I would make a case that, the compound value of having Barnes on the ball with two bigs helping him, especially with Thompson and Mozgov, guys who, you know, while LeBron could, you know, drop it to them for a dunk or throw them a lob over the top, are not guys who are spatially challenging in any way. They're both going to probably be around the rim, or they're going to be setting the screen, and so their defender's going to be involved in the play. I think that kind of triumvirate of defense could be a good option there as well.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what happens when LeBron tries to back down Draymond Green. That's just going to be a war. I'm really looking forward to it. And even Barnes, too. Golden State's been talking up how strong he was. He guarded Zach Randolph, for God's sake, you know. So I really am very curious to see whether anyone, we haven't seen it yet, someone who can guard LeBron and like keep him from backing down. Paul Millsap actually, I thought, did a pretty decent job of that. But you know, he's a little more challenged on the outside. But I think Draymond becomes a much more palatable option if LeBron isn't hitting his jump shot. If he is hitting his jump shot, then you're going to need someone who can get on him and contest and. You know, have kind of that backline help on when they go to the post up, as you said. Before we move on to other topics, anything else that strikes you about this matchup that you wanted to get off your chest?
I can't think of anything in particular. I mean, I'm really looking forward to it, as I imagine a lot of basketball people are, in terms of figuring out what we really know about Cleveland, in terms of, you know, seeing the Warriors with a different kind of test. I think this is going to be a great series.
Seconded. All right. So a couple notable coaching hires since we last recorded. The first one, Scott Skiles in Orlando. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, kind of a shrug. I don't.
Yeah, it's that's kind of how I felt as well. Scott Skiles will have you run some suicides for your shrug, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't feel super strongly about Scott Skiles in any particular way. He's well respected in the profession. He's, I think he's above, 500 career as a coach. Has certainly coached some
pretty solid 443 and 433. I thought it's a very Skilesian record to have, but yeah, he's coached for 13 years, which I never realized was the case, 12, 13 years or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it really starts to add up. It's only been three stints, right? It was Phoenix, Chicago, Milwaukee.
He was in Milwaukee for 5 years. I guess that's where news goes to die. You don't realize how long that was. But yeah, I mean he was there, pretty much. I mean, when did he leave? He left 2013, so he was there from 08 to 2013 or something like that.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy to think about, especially because with the image of Skiles that we have as being a guy who wears down his players, mentally and physically. Who, his voice in terms of, what he's telling his team to be doing can be a little grating. But, for an NBA coach to hang around for 5 years in any spot, much less two in a row, he must have some leverage. He must be well-liked. He must be, which is a weird thing to say of Scott Skiles. But, with the lifespan that coaches have now, I don't know that his particular approach is all the more likely to get him fired in a couple years than anyone else's would be.
Yeah, I mean, this whole idea of, his style is grating on people and, he can only last for a certain amount of time. Number one, not necessarily borne out, as you said, in the amount of time that he spent places, but number two, that's how long coaches get fired for anyway. So, I mean, if you're going to have, some planned obsolescence, maybe that's better than unplanned obsolescence, especially when you can get some good results or suspect that you can during the time that he's actually there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm very, Orlando's roster is weird in a lot of ways, and I don't know that he would be the guy I would pick to shape whatever weirdness is there. I mean, there's obviously a lot of talent.
Well, so when you say it's weird, what do you mean by that?
I mean, just because there are so many guys there who we don't quite know what to make of them yet, whether it's, even Victor Oladipo and Elfrid Payton. Payton, I think, is maybe first and foremost on that list. What you do with, Tobias Harris is going to be a free agent to what, whatever their degree of interest is in bringing him back. Even Nikola Vucevic in terms of what his role is, how much can you trust him to be the center of a good defense? Aaron Gordon is still, missed some time last season, but, still has a lot of raw materials to work with. And he may be the guy that I'm curious to see under Skiles the most, just because in Aaron Gordon, I think there's a lot of defensive potential there. And yet I can't shake the idea of Skiles coaching a young Tyson Chandler out of my head in terms of, guys who are a little raw in terms of what they can do offensively, but could just be such good defenders. And they're kind of kept in this box for maybe a little too long. If Scott Skiles is the same guy that he was earlier in his career, and maybe he's not, maybe he's adjusted, maybe he's changed. I'm sure he's grown in some ways. But I'm very curious to see what he does with some of those younger guys who do have, some unfinished games.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who was able to get a top defense in the league out of a team that was starting Eddie Curry at center for, much of a season. So that was his first full year in Chicago. So, I mean, I think if that might bode well for what he could do with Vucevic. But yeah, I mean, I do think of him as kind of, a defensive coach. He's never been a guy that's had amazing talent offensively, and hasn't been able to really get many results above that talent. But yeah, I mean, I think he's certainly no one that you could ever point to as saying, no one would ever say, all right, he did a bad job in one of these stops, And to me, though, the only downside of it is I think we can all agree that he's not, a top five coach in the league. And when you kind of have a little more freedom of choice in a small market, you might as well try and pick someone new and see if you can find someone like that. I mean, nobody knows who's going to be a great coach until you actually hire him. I think a lot of times you can suspect, but you don't really know. So why not just take a lottery ticket in the hopes that you strike gold?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, there's certainly a play here in terms of what Skiles has meant to the Magic, you know, the familiarity there in terms of the franchise.
Yeah, it worked out great for the Lakers with Byron Scott,
right,
too, right?
Right. I mean, that's just a great criteria for hiring coaches in general, or criterion, I should say. But, yeah, I mean, it comes up with a lot of these guys who have been in and around the league for a while that we'd like to see some fresh blood, that we'd like to see some new faces. Skiles, yeah, again, is fine. I have no real problem with his hiring. I think he'll do some, you know, and especially in this Eastern Conference, assuming that things don't drastically change over the summer, you know, Orlando may not be very far from contending for the playoffs, from being more of a presence there, you know, especially if some of their guys take a you know, significant step forward. But it's just not an inspiring selection by any means. And it's not, as you said, something where we're going to look back at this in a year or two and be really surprised at how things turned out. I think Skiles is pretty much within a set of defined limits in terms of what he can bring to a team for the most part. He's not going to be this lottery ticket of a coach that's really going to bring a ton to the development of the franchise. You know, he's steady, he's smart, he's tough. He obviously brings a lot of this team defensively, as you said, and the potential, especially in the shadow of what he was able to do for those young Bulls, I think is promising.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not expecting anything world-changing here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe he gets his team into the top 10 in defense next year, and we're saying, yeah, it's a pretty good hire, because as you said, you know, he does have a track record of getting young teams to defend, which, you know, a lot, it's hard to do, even if those guys have a lot of natural talent. All right, next coaching hire, Alvin Gentry in New Orleans. Thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I like Gentry a lot in general. I think he's a really smart coach and probably pretty underrated, especially that stint he had in Phoenix, where they were... You know, it's obviously not a rocket science in terms of, you know, making a top defense with Steve Nash as your point guard, but I think they were top two back-to-back years, top 10 the next 2 years. Things went, you know, south really fast once Nash left. But I think he's a really sharp offensive coach, and supposedly that he made, you know, his pitch on the idea that Anthony Davis was being underused offensively, which I think a lot of people who watch basketball might agree with. I think Monty actually did.
But they were still like a top 10 offense, though barely, last year with all those guys hurt. Is there really that much improvement to be made offensively for this team, you think?
Right. That's where the question is. That, I mean, as much as I like Gentry and I like kind of what he brings systemically, I like, you know, he's a guy who's able to get the most out of a limited bench in Phoenix. I like the kind of analog between, you know, him really maximizing Channing Frye there and what that might mean for Ryan Anderson, who had a down shooting year last year. There are little things that I like, but as you said, on the bottom line is that this team was not losing because of their offense. They were losing because, in part, you know, the defensive execution wasn't there, and, you know, despite the personnel where you would expect, and, you know, some of that's injury with, you know, guys like Jrue Holiday, who is an important defensive piece for them in terms of maybe the one guy in their backcourt who you can trust to play big minutes and play good defense on the perimeter. But, you know, with Omer Asik and Anthony Davis playing serious minutes, that should not have been as bad defensive team as it is. And, you know, Davis took made some nice progress in terms of the way he was reading things defensively. By the playoffs, I think he was – I don't know what more you could ask for him in terms of his defensive assignments. I mean, especially when you're switching guys on the perimeter, him coming out to cover Steph Curry on some occasions, and then also, you know, protecting the rim and being a presence inside. He was doing a lot.
Yeah.
And so I'm more curious to see what Gentry can do in terms of, you know, keeping Davis maximized in terms of his defensive value. And it's obviously a big free agent summer for them with you know, the room they're going to have to kind of adjust their roster, and whether they want to play Davis at the five, whether they want to keep him at the four and bring in another center, whether it's Asik back or Robin Lopez again or whoever it may be in terms of a more conventional center option. But I don't know that Gentry is the most heartening defensive hire. I mean, he doesn't have yet an NBA track record of coaching great defenses, so I'm not quite sure what to make of that. I like him in general.
Maybe he learned something from this year's Golden State team that he can apply.
Yeah, maybe so. But yeah, the idea that he would be brought into a team that was so lacking in defense, it's not a perfect fit, but I'm open to seeing how it goes.
Yeah, I think from a political perspective, this makes a ton of sense. I mean, number one, he got a 4-year, $13.75 million deal, according to Woj. So that's really, you know, a little over $3 million a year. And there's a fourth-year team option for $4 million in the last season. Someone like Thibodeau, someone like Van Gundy, those guys were going to want more years and more money You know, and they're also, they moved on from Monty Williams this year, so they're going to be paying him this year too. So I think that those guys, the other options, wouldn't have come as cheaply. Gentry is also someone who's much more affable and gets along with people much better probably than Van Gundy or Thibodeau do. So yeah, I think I understand it from that perspective, especially if you're a somewhat embattled GM, why you go with someone who, you know, is a very good option to be sure, but also not someone who's going to potentially alienate people or, you know, get into some kind of a power struggle with you.
No, that's a great point. I mean, Gentry is as affable as coaches come. I think he's going to be a very easy personality there, and maybe, you know, maybe that fits with the team that they have particularly well. I certainly don't see there being any objection there. It's much more to do with, in terms of my questions, less about how he fits as a personality and more just about the defensive stuff and what exactly that's going to mean for that team.
Yeah, I agree. We'll see. And we'll see, you know, Oshik doesn't strike me as a guy who is a huge Gentry ball type of dude. And maybe the approach is going to be now to have Anthony Davis be the starting center and Anderson play at the four. You know, but then again, your defense is probably going to struggle a little bit in that regard. So we'll have to see what they end up with, whether they stick with Oshik. I mean, it makes sense to re-sign him from a cap perspective because really they're only going to have probably, you know, $9 or $10 million. You probably can't replace him with that amount of money with how the center market's going to be. But anyway, so let's move on to as a little sequitur here, which we normally don't do on this show, another free agent center in Dallas, Tyson Chandler. You're based in Dallas. You've been a Dallas guy for a long time. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think you got your start writing about the Mavs. So what do you think of what their offseason looks like? I mean, and maybe the place to start is, you know, how good can this team be if they were to just bring everybody back next year?
I think they would be pretty solid still. You know, I think they're certainly a playoff team still. You know, assuming Monte opts back in, they're able to re-sign Tyson. Al-Farouq Aminu, I think, is a big part of that too, just because he could be a bigger part than I think he was this past season. I think we saw some of that in the playoffs. Maybe, you know, one of the more underutilized players on the roster, just in terms of getting his feet wet and really finding his way in the offense, and then earning Rick Carlisle's trust, which is always a big part of things here in Dallas. But I think they could still be pretty solid, but they definitely have a cap. I don't think they're a particularly compelling contender just yet, and I think we saw why in the playoffs, where when every matchup matters so much, it's still a little easy to take advantage of what they do defensively. There's too many holes, and you know they're not going to bring back Rajon Rondo, so that's probably off the table right now. And so There's some big questions in terms of what to do with that point guard spot. If it's a healthy Devin Harris or you know Raymond Felton or whatever it may be. Of the, you know, the resources currently available, I just don't see it as being enough to make them a particularly interesting team come playoff time. But they're also a team that doesn't have a lot of assets to flip. You know, there's been a lot of talk lately about, you know, Ty Lawson being interested in Dallas, and of course Dallas being interested in Ty Lawson, but how you make those, you know, that kind of acquisition work, I don't really know.
Yeah, in terms of young players who are actually under contract, not a ton of assets there, and their draft assets are impacted because they owe that pick to the Celtics because of the Rondo trade in the future. Let's start with Tyson Chandler, right? So he made $14.8 million next year. How good was he last year, and how much do you think that can hold with him going to be 33 just before next season starts?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was pretty good, all told, especially given where he was with the Knicks previously. And there have been hints along the way that a lot of that had to do with his health, you know, nagging injuries, and a lot of it had to do with the situation in New York where he was very obviously not happy. He was a good center for them, but not quite, you know, the defensive player of the year caliber influence that they need. And especially with Dirk, you know, where he is defensively at this point in his career and how much help he needs, and with how much help Monte Ellis needs and sometimes Chandler Parsons needs, and you know, before Rajon Rondo, how much Jameer Nelson, you know, really needed help. I mean, Chandler had his hands full, maybe more than any center in the NBA in terms of what he was asked to cover for. So in the playoffs, we saw that a lot where, you know, Chandler rotates and it's a lob over the top, or Chandler rotates and Dwight Howard gets a free dunk, or there's a cut down the baseline. I mean, he was put in a bad spot. And so that's kind of the interesting thing about this summer, too, where you know, we talk about free agency a lot from the team perspective in terms of, oh, should Dallas bring Tyson Chandler back or should they chase after DeAndre Jordan or whatever it is. But if you're Tyson Chandler and you're looking at this team and all that you have to do to make them playoff tested and playoff caliber, I don't know that he, you know, I imagine he'll have some better options in terms of, you know, maybe he loves Dallas, maybe he loves the other guys on this team, the veterans, the coach. But I think he's going to have some choices, and I'm curious to see if Dallas is really the spot for him, given that they really don't have a lot to help him with defensively right now.
DeAndre Jordan has been talked about now as someone with whom the Mavs might have a flirtation in the offseason. If they sign him, presumably that would be for the max. That's about $19 million. Then the only other guys under contract, you know, if we assume that Ellis opts out and Aminu opts out, which I think you agree with me that that's likely in both those cases.
Yes.
Yeah, so because Ellis would be making you know, about $8 million next year, and Aminu only $1 million, so that makes sense for them. So you would then have Chandler Parsons making $15 million, Dirk at 8.3, Devin Harris at $4 million, Felton, he has a player option which I think he'll exercise, so that's 3.9. Maybe they stretch him to open up another $2 million of space. That gets you to maybe $30 million, $32 million in cap room. You spend 19 of that on DeAndre Jordan, and now you got, you know, 12 or 13 left, the room exception and minimums to fill out the rest of the roster. I mean, if they do that with Jordan, does that get them anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, that the difference between DeAndre Jordan and Tyson Chandler at this stage is maybe not so significant as to make them a dramatically different team. You know, he's a younger version. He's a better shot blocker, but also maybe a less reliable rotational defender. I mean, DeAndre Jordan still has that tendency to leave his feet a lot. He's still, you know, there are times where you can just catch him in very weird places defensively when he should be walling off, you know, a particular guy off the dribble or whatever it may be. I think I trust Chandler a little bit more to be in the right place at the right time at this point. And so that's where things get a little weird, because DeAndre Jordan, we really haven't seen what he can do without superior playmaking next to him offensively. I mean, if you take away Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, and, you know, the Mavs have some nice guys who can, I mean, like, even guys like Chandler Parsons are facilitators for big man offense in some ways. They're able to, you know, throw those lobs over the top, or, you know, they're able to create little openings for a guy like DeAndre or a guy like Tyson Chandler. So that's nice. But just a very different ball game when you're talking about a team that's starting point guard maybe Harris or Felton, or, you know, they're not going to have a lot to work with in free agency. You know, I'm curious to see who's going to be available via trade in terms, you know, with the assets that they have to throw at something. I don't love the immediate fit, but I think at that point what you're looking at is, you know, you want the full length of DeAndre Jordan's contract and what he could potentially mean for you 2-3 years down the line. And that's where things get even weirder, because Chandler Parsons, who's a core piece of this team right now, is only under contract for 2 more seasons, maybe 1 if he opts out. And so it's if you're the Mavericks, it's really hard to plan ahead right now, given that they have picks owed to other teams. Dirk Nowitzki has been the centerpiece of this team for so long, is clearly in decline, may have this contract left, and after that, who knows? But other than that, they really just don't have the pieces to build around in an interesting and lasting way.
Yeah, you know, I think, like, my advice to them, frankly, if they didn't have Dirk right now, would be to just try and trade Parsons for whatever you could and really just blow it up and start over. You know, that's especially after Dirk took, you know, so much less below his market value, a 3-year, $25 million deal last summer. That's not really an option. But, you know, I don't see a way for them to ascend kind of beyond the level they are, whether they bring everyone back or whether they don't. One question that I had, I mean, in watching that series with Houston, it occurred to me that maybe Nowitzki just can't be the starting power forward on a championship team because of what it would mean for your defense. Where do you fall on that question at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very real concern. And one that, you know, the Mavs have to be wrestling with this summer, especially when, you know, they've been linked to guys like LaMarcus Aldridge, for example, who, while that sounds great in theory, and LaMarcus Aldridge is a Dallas guy, you know, I don't know whether that matters to him or not, but he and Dirk just can't really play together. That's not a reasonable option for any length of time. And so you really have to start thinking about what Dirk's future with this franchise is going to be, what his value is, because offensively he's still, you know, even, you know, this wasn't a great shot-making season for him, but the demands that he puts on a defense are pretty substantial. I think he's still a great, relevant player in the NBA. But yeah, I mean, when he's that big of a defensive problem, and some of that has to do with, you know, the rest of the lineup around him too, where Chandler's really only the plus defender of the bunch. I'm curious to see, you know, if you can get better defenders at the one and two, or at least one of those positions, how does that change kind of the complexion of what that matchup and what those, you know, pick and rolls that involve Dirk and what that whole sequence is going to be like? Because, you know, Rondo was fine for stretches, but really wasn't, you know, much of a defensive influence in that series when he did play. And then when he didn't, I mean, you're asking an awful lot of an injured Devin Harris and Raymond Felton in terms of handling some of those pick and roll situations, and then missing Parsons entirely obviously shifted the depth chart. But if, you know, if Aminu is playing more, for example, if they're able to get somebody like maybe a Patrick Beverley, if he's healthy and, you know, they're able to pry him away in restricted free agency over the summer, I do wonder how having a little more help around Dirk might influence things there, but it doesn't look good for his defensive future right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about what this team really needs, let's say you're just saying, all right, Devin Harris will be our starting point guard, and we got Dirk and we got Parsons. We need to fill in around that. You know, I think a defensive center like DeAndre Jordan is a pretty good start, but I also think you can kind of get a reasonable facsimile of someone like him for a little bit less when you consider the center market. But I think what they really, really need is a stopper on the wing, because that's not Parsons. You know, Monte Ellis, another subpar defender. Do you see them moving on from him? I'm struggling to see them deciding to bring him back. What do you think?
I'm in the same boat. It's one of those things where when you take Monte off the roster, there's a real risk that this team just doesn't have enough of kind of what we were talking about earlier, of that ability to force the initial defensive rotation. Monte, for all of his faults, he's a really dynamic player off the dribble. He forces the defense into movement and action. He doesn't always make the best decisions out of those situations. He doesn't always finish at the rim as well as you would like, but he at least gets things going. And so you run a risk if Devin Harris is your point guard and you go with more of an off-ball guy at the two, you run a little bit of a risk of things getting stagnant, especially with Dirk not in a state where he can carry the bulk of an offense every night for the extent of the regular season. And that's where Chandler Parsons gets interesting, because Parsons, in a limited run last season, turned out to be a really good pick-and-roll creator for them. The problem is that between him and, you know, for most of the season, Rondo and Monte Ellis all there, there just wasn't that much of a window for him to do a lot of offensive creation. And so I think, you know, from a laboratory standpoint, I would be very curious to see if, you know, if Devin Harris is a starting point guard, make a run at a Danny Green type in free agency, a guy who is a really good defensive player, a knockdown shooter who moves without the ball, and you put a little more responsibility on Chandler Parsons to create along with Dirk, and maybe you bring Tyson back, or you try to make DeAndre work, or whatever it is. But I definitely think Parsons can do a little more in terms of generating offense for this team than he did last season. And if you're paying him what you're paying him, I think it's at least worth seeing that through and seeing if he can provide that, just because the other options are not great.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that they need someone who's a better defensive player on the wing. They just don't have any kind of a stopper. And when Dirk Nowitzki is one of your health defenders, you're not in good shape if you're also going to have guys who are going to get blown by at the point of attack. So, yeah, I mean, that sounds like I see them kind of, you know, doing about what you said, where they're going to get someone on the wing, hopefully, who can play as a stopper, and then some kind of a center, you know, whether it's Chandler. I don't know that bringing in DeAndre really helps him that much for next year. Maybe, as you mentioned, that's more of a long-term play for when the cap goes up to get him on kind of a value contract. But it's tough. I mean, as much as you want to say that Monte Ellis is the problem and he can't defend, he's still making a value contract at $8 million, at least when you consider free agents. The problem is they don't really have anyone around who's on a cheap contract who's really going to be making way less than what they're worth. And it's so hard to build an adequate team when that's the case.
No, it's very true. I mean, the thing with Monte is, I mean, he gets, you know, a lot of criticism, and he has throughout his career. He's a good player and a skilled player, certainly. The problems come where he's really damn hard to build around. And if he's a focal part of your team, I mean, you have to have basically, you know, a point guard who can potentially guard some twos if you're going to shift Monte over to defend the one sometimes, depending on what the matchup looks like, but who doesn't need the ball, but who can shoot, because Monte really can only hit threes from the corners. And then you need a three who's basically the same thing in terms of a guy who's not going to be demanding a ton of touches, but can contribute, but can cut, but can shoot, but can defend his position. I mean, it's kind of the same way with Dirk at this point in his career, where you're looking at these two pieces that are valuable in very specific ways, but are so demanding on the rest of your team, and whether you can build a top tier contender, or at least a team that's a plausible championship contender with two of those guys around, is a real challenge, especially in terms of making the math work, as you mentioned, where, yeah, Monte at 8.4 is not a bad deal at all, and certainly not, you know, what it was ridiculed as being when he signed that deal, in terms of what he would mean for the Mavericks franchise. And he's, I think, by and large, done what he was brought there to do. It's just a question of how do you build a team around that.
Yeah, and he's also, I mean, he's going to be getting into his 30s now, so he's the type of guy and has the type of game where I would expect a pretty steep decline from him in the next couple of years anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's already bad defensively. And once the explosion goes, his jumper isn't what you would want of an aging veteran. He doesn't have like a post game or any kind of, you know, wily element that could really make him a lasting impact, you know, a lasting influence as a scorer. It's going to be a weird transition away from being the fastest dude on the court, Monte Ellis, to whatever he is, you know, at the next stage of his career.
Well, so have you thought about this? I don't mean to put you on the spot if you haven't had a chance to get into this yet, but what's an ideal off season for the Mavs, realistically, with some of the salaries that the potential free agents are going to get?
Yeah, it's tough. And a lot of it too is framed by Chandler Parsons' injury and surgery, and, you know, what exactly his availability is going to be, because if he's missing a significant portion next season, I do wonder, you know, how that changes the Mavs' long-term thinking. I wonder if maybe the play for them in some ways, in a value sense, is to investigate guys like Wes Matthews and Damari Carroll, who are, you know, who could be really good wing fits for them in terms of what they need, but who have some serious question marks in terms of what their health's going to look like, especially Wes Matthews, where, you know, that injury is career shaping in a lot of ways. And so it'd be a risk. But, you know, when you're banking on a couple years of Parsons, you're banking on the rest of Dirk's prime, and you really don't have a lot of options in terms of picks, you know, picks or players to trade on the roster. I mean, they're going to have to cut corners somewhere. They're going to have to take leaps of faith somewhere if they want to be an immediately competitive team. I think the best case scenario involves letting Monte walk. I think it involves bringing Al-Farouq Aminu back. And honestly, I don't think it makes too big of a difference whether it's Tyson Chandler or DeAndre Jordan, who ends up being the starting center for the Mavs next season, if it's one of those two things. But if they can't get at least one of those two guys, things go south very, very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I at this point, I predict that they're one of the more likely playoff teams in the West to fall out next year when you're going to have Oklahoma City healthy. I think people expect New Orleans will be better. The Jazz are going to be better, one would think, also, if they play the way they played the second half of the year. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough for them, unless they improve, to maintain the position that they're in, much less take another step. So, yeah, I mean, it's tough. You just, when you're trying to fill things out with cap space, the other thing, too, is, like, Dirk, you know, he's going to probably play 30 minutes a game, you know, if he's one of your best players. I mean, Parsons is going to be coming off an injury. How many minutes can he play? If you bring Chandler back, he's not going to be able to play a lot of minutes. Devin Harris always struggles with injuries. He's not a huge minute player. And now you're bringing guys with cap space. Yeah, you might get some big-ticket items, but your depth is going to be really bad too. So, again, they're sort of years of not doing well in the draft or trading away draft picks really coming home to roost here just in the absence of cheap talent that's on this team.
It really has. I mean, the one thing that the Mavs, I think, are pretty consistently good at is finding guys at the minimum who can be at least good contributors, you know, at least relative to what their role is going to be in the rotation. But even now, I mean, J.J. Barea was a shockingly and in some cases depressingly important part of what the Mavs were doing in the playoffs. You know, like when he's that big a part of your, you know, some of that's just relative to what else they could get out of the point guard position. And, you know, Barea's penetration was valuable to them in the same way that Monte's was or other guys could, you know, what they could do off the dribble. But he's going to be, you know, more than a minimum player this summer. And so he's going to demand money to keep. And then you're also looking at, you know, basically their entire center rotation is in free agency now, even down to guys like Amari Stoudemire and Bernard James, Greg Smith, who, you know, they're not going to bring most of those guys back. But you have to find bodies to fill that spot now that, you know, Tyson's a free agent, now that you've traded away Brandon Wright. And as you said, I mean, with their picks in terms of making some iffy decisions, to say, you know, to be generous in terms of who they've selected in drafts past. It's really tough. And, you know, even with the cap set to explode, and maybe some of the people they signed this summer will turn out to be the kinds of bargains that are great down the road, and maybe that's the way forward, is to try to be an active player this summer in free agency and try to, you know, find those guys and pick out those guys who, if you sign them to three-year deals, can be a great value for a couple seasons. Because right now they don't have the rookie scale guys. They don't have the value contracts that they can deal. They just don't have a lot to work with.
All right, last question here, because I know you have to go. If you're the Mavs GM, if another team offered to just let you trade Chandler Parsons into their cap space for free, essentially, you get nothing back. You just get to move on from his $15.3 million this year, potentially $16 million next year. Do you make that trade?
I don't think I do. Just because, not, you know, even putting aside whatever expectations and pressures there are within the organization to be at least solid or a good team immediately, I still have a lot of hope in Chandler Parsons and what he's able to do. You know, he's never going to be a first option player, maybe even a stretch as a second option player, but I think he's versatile enough. I think he's interesting enough to keep around, especially when, as we've said, I mean, you're going to have to make some pretty considerable changes to your team in order to make a big splash relative to where they were this year, to make any kind of significant headway. And I don't know that those options are there this summer, just in terms of opening up enough cap space that you could bring in some quality guys, in part because if you're a free agent, I don't know, you know, if you're looking at Dallas's roster, the appeal of playing with Dirk may still be great. He's an NBA, you know, an established NBA superstar over the course of his career. He's an easy guy to work with and to play alongside. He's going to create things for you offensively with the way he shoots the ball. But, I mean, as much as you might like Dallas and might want to work for Mark Cuban and might respect Rick Carlisle and Dirk, I don't know that there's going to be a lot of guys that are just banging down the door to come to Dallas this summer. And so opening up that cap space when you don't have the trade assets to facilitate some kind of other deal isn't that intriguing to me, especially when Parsons may well be off the books next summer. So, I mean, if you're that worried about what his contract looks like right now, he may be opting out anyway. And if not, I'm not scared by the length of his deal relative to his talent, I don't think.
I think I would respectfully disagree with you. And there's a couple reasons. Number one is the surgery, which is troubling. There's been reports that it might be microfracture. We don't really know exactly what it was. I think he actually declined to provide further detail in an interview that he did, with an outlet that I can't remember. That's real specific. I think that's what I recall. And then when you also consider Dirk's defensive limitations, then I think you get to the point where you need two guys on the wing who are going to be good defensive players. I think that you could do better with his $15 million in free agency this year, and then also potentially get a guy that you could hold on to for when the cap expands and be a value contract. With Parsons, you don't have that upside. If he becomes a value contract, he'll instantly opt out and try and get more. So I think with both the injury situation and just the fit with him not being really a premium offensive player, and I thought his salary was somewhat of an artifact of a really inflated wing market last year. That's not so much the case this year when you have some better wings on the market. I might be willing to do that. I mean, that's, you know, we're kind of getting out into the ether here of, things that aren't really going to happen probably, especially when you consider they just signed him and they celebrated so hard that they signed him and all that stuff. And he's a good chemistry guy and a good recruiter. But yeah, I think I would view him as, you know, not really a value contract at this point in time.
No, I mean, at his dollar value, it's asking a lot of him to live up to that, especially with, as you mentioned, I mean, the injury stuff is looming over all of this in a big way, in a very concerning way. I think the thing with Dirk is, I mean, this cuts, you know, this whole exercise you said is really hypothetical and is really getting, you know, out of kind of the tangible part of NBA team building and all that, but it's also cutting kind of to the core of where this team is. And, you know, we're definitely transitioning out of the stage where building around Dirk makes sense. And when going so far to accommodate what he doesn't do and what he can't do, what the limits of that may be, you know, Dirk is, you know, still a really good NBA player, I think. But he just hasn't aged in the same way that, say, a Tim Duncan has, where he's still so reliable.
Yeah, well,
most of the
no one has.
Right, I mean, right. No human being in the history of humanity has.
As well as you could hope, yeah. I mean, but, you know, it's still the vagaries of time affects us all, I guess. So one last thing here. We've been doing this on the podcast. Number one, do you anything that you want to plug? And number two, any non-basketball thing that you can recommend for the listeners?
Ooh, nothing specific to plug. You know, check out SI.com for all of our playoff coverage. You know, I'll be doing plenty, but we have a pretty extensive squad running through stuff, so be sure to stop by.
Yeah. And Rob, by the way, is probably, I would say, the best actual writer covering the NBA on a day-to-day basis. You know, unless you're writing like magazine features, it uses the language in a way that I am frankly quite jealous of. So that's definitely a reason to check out his work for sure.
I really appreciate that. Thank you, Nate. As far as something else to plug, I can't really think of anything too outside the box. Caught Mad Max Fury Road a week ago. That's obviously been plugged to death, but do yourself a favor and block out some time and make a date of it, because it's worth every second, I think.
Really? All right. Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. I also see like two movies a year, but we'll. I have a girlfriend now, so I actually, you know, have someone to go with me. So maybe I will check that out potentially later today. All right. Rob Mahoney, thanks a lot for coming on. We really appreciate it. What's your Twitter handle so people can follow you?
Yeah, you can follow me at Rob Mahoney. Super creative with it. Come check me out.
Well, it's always like, I feel like it's better to just go with your name, because like I think all these people who like pick something that's like not their name, you want something that has some upside. It's just a little weird when you like finally, you know, if you become known and then you have something that's not your name and you have to like sort of, this extra step is needed to identify you with your name. So I think you made the right choice, Rob Mahoney. Sadly, Nate Duncan was not available. I had to go with Nate Duncan NBA. So that's where you can follow me on Twitter. Thanks again to Rob for coming on. Make sure you check out his work on SI.com, covering the finals. Really, really good writer. Thanks again, Rob.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me, Nate.